Welcome to Fermentality. I'm your host, Kat Pierce with Atlantic Brew Supply, and we're homebrewers talking homebrew and sharing fermentation. All right, Eric, thank you so much for joining us for Fermentality. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how long you've been shopping with Atlantic Brew Supply?
Sure. Thanks, Kat. I'm just super excited to be on your show today. And I've been a customer since the store opened. I'm not sure if
years.
That was, 2012, 2013. So, it's been, you guys have been my local homebrew store and buying fresh ingredients from you guys for, a decade.
Excellent. So what do you do for a living? So you don't work in the beer industry, but you're obviously a very avid home brewer. But what is it that you do on the daily?
I'm an IT executive in the area. It seems like a lot of different home brewers I know tend to be engineers or in IT, but absolutely not required. It's just I love process. I love troubleshooting, figuring things out, making things better. So I think that's a hobby that goes hand in hand with what I like to do professionally too.
Absolutely. There are a lot of people that I've noticed that are homebrewers that are either in some form of STEM or medicine. It's really interesting seeing all of these folks that, on the daily when they're at work, they're focusing on problem solving and they're being very intentional and following a process and an SOP, and then they get into brewing and it's still very much of a process, but in the same breath, it allows you to be creative.
Oh yeah, much more creativity. And if something's a little bit off, and it's if it's not broken, but it's just maybe a little bit different than how you planned for it to be, no problem. But you've got that freedom to sort of do whatever you want.
Awesome. Well, it looks like you brought some beers for us today. What did you bring for us today?
I brought one of our club recipes. So I'm in a homebrew club, and we have a New England IPA that we've been working on over the last few years, really, just to have a good recipe in our toolkit for everybody in our homebrew club to make a pretty good New England IPA. So I've got actually two variations of that. And then I've got a Maybach, which that's sort
very
of
seasonally appropriate.
Yes, and that goes back to that's a shout out to Carolina Brewing Company and their Spring Bock, which was one of the beers that made me fall in love with craft beer.
Awesome. Well, did you want to open one of them now? We'll start out with one, and then we'll open up some more.
Sure,
later
that'd be
on.
Great. Maybe you start with the Spring Bock.
Yeah, let's do it. I absolutely love Maybach, and not enough people make them. So when I had the opportunity to have one, I'm like, yay! Hey, Matthew, I've got one over here. So for those of you who are listening right now, I am chatting with our production manager, I guess is what we're calling you. I don't know. But Matthew definitely needs to partake in this.
Just go ahead and pour one for him first.
Excellent. Awesome. The color is gorgeous and the clarity is absolutely brilliantly clear. Talk to me about your clarifying process. Everyone does something a little bit different.
Sure. For a lot of beers, I'm not overly concerned about that. Over time, gravity will drop anything out of it. If you're in a rush, I think with this one, I did use a little bit of gelatin in the keg just to clear it up a little bit faster to get it ready for some family that I had visiting. And, if you see a beer that's supposed to be clear and it is clear, that tells your brain that it's going to be delicious versus a beer that you think is supposed to be clear and it's hazy, then that just kind of I guess the saying is you eat with your eyes first, and I think the same is true with beer.
Oh, absolutely, 100%. This is absolutely beautiful. I mean, it's got a nice sweet breadiness to it, in addition to some subtle hop character in there. I mean, it is pretty damn true to style as far as I can tell. Man, this is awesome.
I appreciate it. It's one of those things where I don't make it all the time, but probably maybe once a year or so. I do like to rebrew beers and just work on a recipe over time, but I don't like to brew it a whole bunch at once. I
right.
get tired of the beer style, and that actually can lead to homebrewing burnout too, if you just have a bunch of beer sitting around that is the same.
Yeah, I'm definitely one where sometimes if, you know, I'm interested in making a particular style, but I know it's not going to be a style that I'm going to drink a lot of, I'll do a much smaller batch. Like I'll do about a 2.5 gallon. I actually bought one of those torpedo kegs that are sitting over there specifically for that reason. In addition for, you know, when people say, hey, would you mind making a beer for my event? I'll be like, yeah, absolutely. About how many people? And generally, it's not enough people to go through a 5 gallon keg. But so, yeah, I bought the 2.5 gallon keg for that reason. And, you know, I think
those are great. It gives you a lot more flexibility, too, if you're not real sure what you want to do with the batch, either for dry hopping or maybe adding flavors is a better example. Then you could split a batch into 2.5 and 2.5 even. Gives you a little bit more freedom without, you know, especially if you don't have a bunch of neighbors and friends close by that want to help you with your homebrew, then 5 gallons in one style can be a lot to move through.
Yeah, absolutely. I find that for me, the beers that generally go through faster at home are something light and easy drinking because, you know, working in a homebrew shop and having a sister company as a brewery that's right next door to us, you know, I get the opportunity to have so many different styles of beer, but sometimes at the end of the day, I just want something light and easy drinking.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's always the first to go. Anytime I've done anything upwards of, you know, 8-9%, generally go for a half batch or something for
yeah,
that reason.
Absolutely.
It tends to stick around a little bit in the kegs.
So how did you get started homebrewing and what was it specifically that made the hobby stick for you? You know, there are a lot of people that have hobby ADD like myself and, you know, I get into something and I'm all excited about it to start out and then it just fizzles out. What
sure.
was it specifically that
yeah,
made it stick?
I was interested probably like a lot of people that get into it because I had a friend that was homebrewing. It's actually a friend in Charlotte and he said, hey, you know, my friend, my family does one batch a year. We do it as a group, with a couple other friends. Why don't you come down, hang out for the weekend and check it out? And he knew that I was big into craft beer and interested in that. So I joined his family for that. I got to stir the pot a few times and saw that it was really actually simple, approachable. It was something that I could do with just that I could get into with just a little bit of gear that was already in my kitchen. So I was immediately excited about it. My mom around that time had asked me what I was interested in for Christmas and I said, yeah, you know, like buy like a homebrew book would be really cool. So lo and behold, she bought me John Palmer's How to Brew.
Nice.
And I read it front to back like it was a thriller novel in less than 24 hours and was really excited about the chemistry, all the the biology, the tinkering, the engineering behind it, and thought like, wow, this really is, you know, a hobby that I could get into. It's a lot of fun. It's not too expensive, approachable. There's a lot to learn. I love learning. So if, and I feel like this is a great hobby for that because I'm never done. I've never know it all. I just find out how much, you know, I don't know the more that I brew, how much that's unresearched with, you know, all different yeast strains and hop strains and the interaction between those. I was after reading that book, I was pretty hooked and couldn't wait to get home and start putting my gear together. And that was about 2009 or 2010 maybe. A lot of homebrew equipment out there, but not like what you have today with pre-built systems that were
right.
readily available, that were affordable. And so John Palmer had me going back and forth between different hardware stores, trying to piece things together, got my system built out. But I wanted to brew all grain, but I just, you know, I couldn't do that immediately because of all the equipment and ordering things. So I did hit the local homebrew store, and I guess at that point you guys weren't here yet, but and picked up some kits and did 3 extract kits in 3 weeks.
Oh wow!
And I was so excited about it, and did a. My first all-grain batch, a strong dark Belgian, which in retrospect is probably the stupidest all-grain batch to do first. It can be, you know, more complicated and, you know, length of time to boil stuff down, all that kind of thing. So I had about 4 batches of beer in bottles just waiting. And my wife looked at me and was like, maybe you should wait to see if any of it's good before you brew anymore. Like, just very kindly, like, hey, that is, you know, what
that's
is that, 8
smart.
Cases of beer. And, you know, that's maybe a little bit gung-ho. But, I, you know, just from the beginning, I was just, you know, fascinated with the process and being able to create something at home. I think anybody that is likes to cook or you know, grill, barbecue, etc., it's all about, you know, being able to control the flavors and you know, the style, whatever you're looking for, tailored to you. So it's a cool, you know, if you enjoy cooking, then, you know, I think homebrew is right there in line with that.
Absolutely. I definitely was that person that really enjoyed cooking, which is part of the reason why I got into it. I mean, I got into it primarily because I got into the commercial industry first and wanted to learn more about the process. And I think for me, specifically, the reason why I continue with this hobby is because there is never anything that I haven't learned yet, right? So I'm consistently learning. I'm consistently dialing in my process. And, you know, you talk about John Palmer's How to Brew, that book, like sparking your interest in everything. For me, what really got me into homebrewing was actually primarily not just needing to understand the process, but needing to understand the process in order to take the Cicerone test.
Right.
So
wow.
For me,
yeah.
Like I was really big into sensory. And so the Tasting Beer by Randy Mosher book is what really got me into it. And I think that particular book got me interested in homebrewing, even though it wasn't a book about homebrewing. So yeah. I definitely feel the reason for the hobby sticking being continuously learning and continuously growing.
Yeah, and I mean, there's, I feel like any hobby, there's different stages that you can be in with the hobby. So in different paces, like whether you're, you know, golfing and trying to perfect your swing and you're out there every, you know, every Saturday, or if you only have time to be out there once a month, you know, whatever pace works for you is the right pace. But and finding that right, you know, cadence is, you know, can make it something that's a sticky lifetime hobby too. So, you know, at first it's all, you know, it was really sticky because of the, you know, how much fun it was and, you know, the geekiness behind the chemistry and, and the processes and everything. And after that, though, it was sticky for a different reason. Local homebrew club, a store said, hey, you know, we're having a competition coming up. And I think this is 2 years after I started brewing. They encouraged me to enter some of my beers. So I did, and I even stewarded for that. And I was like, man, this is really cool. You know, like that was my first glimpse of seeing that you could sit down and try, you know, 8-10 different homebrews of the same style that various people had brewed, and really get to try all, you know, see the difference and variations between all of them and see what works and what didn't work and be able to say, wow, you know, this is great, because now I know what styles I want to brew next and how I want to brew it. I don't want to brew it that way because that didn't taste right, but, you know, this was amazing and I want to shoot for this part of the style whenever I brew it. And so I won, that was my first competition. I won three awards, 2 first places and a 2nd place.
Nice.
Right off the bat. So I was hooked on competitions at that point, and just, you know, like the whole experience of being together with other homebrewers and people that really loved beer. Sort of beyond that, had done that for a little while, and homebrew store had said, you know, we don't know if we're going to be able to do that competition again because we don't have enough BJCP certified judges, and it would be great if you could, you know, look into that because we're gonna have need for those in the next round. So a couple months later, I immediately booked myself for the next one that was coming up, and a few months later, taking the exam. Probably, I feel like the hardest exam I'd ever taken, just, you know, a lot of studying. But, you know, in retrospect, it might have been a little bit easier if I hadn't tried to cram for it in a month. And it's something that over time you're gonna find those answers through homebrewing and either brew clubs or taking classes like Atlantic Brew Supply offers to fill in and some of those cracks. So that was it just really opened a lot of even more interest and more doors as I started judging and going different places to judge beer for different competitions. Beer judging is a whole lot of fun. It's a great experience for anybody that's, you know, sort of thinking about, you know, what that might look like, or if you should go. I would say you definitely should go, sign up as a steward, and you can learn a little bit more about it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I started to judge in Moxville out at the, Pro Refrigeration location. Mm-hmm. And so when I first started getting into sensory, I really wanted to see exactly how judges were able to dissect beer and analyze beer. And so I decided to steward. And that, to me, was the point in which I knew that I wanted to go for Cicerone and or BJCP. And so from then on, I judged even when I wasn't completely certified yet. Because as long as you're paired with a certified judge, you're good to go.
Yeah. A lot of people think that they're, oh, I can't go judge or steward. I'm not qualified. I'm like, no, if you can, you know, identify, you know, just... if you know what good beer is and what, you know, beer that you don't like, then, and you can read a style guideline, then you're most of the way there to be able to help judge.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And more specifically, like you were talking about, being able to dissect just one style at a time, mm-hmm. to where you can go through and look at eight different versions of the same style. You're always going to get one that's like really bad and then one that's like really good. And then relatively good and or mediocre in the middle.
Yeah. What I love, though, is it really is like a crash course in that style, or a refresher. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like crowdsourcing that effort on what that style can be like, and, you know, the gamut of good and bad, and or of, you know, one extreme of the style side to the other.
Yeah, absolutely. So it is no secret that you have entered in multiple competitions. What is it that you do to prepare for a competition when you're entering a beer?
It's part of it is just sort of planning or timing what it is that you'd like to enter. I like to try to enter different styles just so that I'm becoming a better brewer across those different styles. My secret weapon is probably my homebrew club. Mm-hmm. And we do lots of different group brews throughout the year. So the recently I won a competition with the New England IPA and
the quarterly brew off.
I've won first place in other competitions with similar recipes, and that's a club recipe that we worked on. Brewed it in advance of the competition so that it would be fresh. So if something like, you know, a hoppy IPA is something that's fresh, is always going to beat something that's not fresh, hands down, every time.
Absolutely.
And so you don't want to be entering a beer that's 4 weeks old. You want to be entering it, you know, 3 days after it's ready. And you know, the fresher the better for that goes, or as far as that goes. Some planning. I also tend to, you know, some small things is I keg. I used to bottle. I think we're talking about what makes this hobby sticky, and definitely moving from bottling to kegging helped continue to make it sticky because it's just a little bit less effort. The quality of my beer was better. I don't have a whole ton of patience, so like shortening that window between it being finished fermenting and carbonated, kegging just it cuts that in half, if not more so. So I tend to leave the beer in the keg until I'm ready to bottle it and take it to the competition. Generally, I'll drop a beer off the last day or day before last so that it's as fresh as possible. I don't know generally how it's going to be treated or what kind of journey it's going to take between when I drop it off and judging. It can be in an organizer's garage for a week or two. And, you know, if you have any oxygen in that beer and it's sitting at room temperature and you don't do a good job bottling it, that oxidation is going to come out. So, you know, it really is not just a strategy about having the best beer, but also, you know, packaging.
Right.
There's so many things, but Making sure that you enter your beer into the correct category is a huge one.
Ding, ding, ding,
it's,
ding.
Yeah,
ding.
It's and I'm, you know, I'm guilty from time to time of missing that too. And again, you know, being in a club is helpful. We generally, before the competition, we'll share our beers at a club meeting and say, hey, this is what I'm entering. This is what I'm thinking of entering it in as. And people are like, oh, no, no, don't enter it. Like, that might be what you brewed it as, but it really is more like this other style that's close, but, you know, you didn't put enough chocolate or roasted malt in it, so maybe it's this style instead. Or it's not hoppy or strong or bitter enough, so maybe it's, you know, an American pale ale instead of an IPA or something of that nature. So having some of that feedback before competitions is you know, helpful to, you know, if your beer is entered into the right category and you've done a good job packaging it, then you are ahead of the curve.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. I mean, I consistently have given people feedback about packaging also in regards to reducing oxidation when they're actually filling it and using CO2 and all of that jazz. But even, you know, for a competition organizer, for me, just to kind of put this out there, it doesn't really do much to help you in regards to, you know, winning. But when you're putting that label on the bottle, you know, maybe take some masking tape or whatever, and essentially kind of the way I said MacGyver laminate it, so that sure. way the label doesn't get wet and then it doesn't get lost, and then as a result your entry doesn't get lost in the entire competition. You know, a lot of people say, hey, make sure that it's either in a Ziploc bag. Ziploc bag works great, you know, but put two rubber bands on that over the bottle and ensure that that label is protected, because there are a lot of people that during the competition they'll actually put these competition bottles in a cooler with ice, and ice melts and it becomes water. And if your label gets wet, then you're not going to be able to read that, and therefore your beer's not even going to get judged. Right. So that's simple little things like that make a major difference.
Make it easy for the competition organizer. And it's, there have been a lot of times where, or you got your beers mixed up and you put it in the wrong style completely just because you got your labels mixed up. I've seen that before too.
I saw that with a past quarterly brew off. But speaking of competitions in the quarterly brew off, part of the reason you're here is because before COVID happened, you had won the popular vote at the end of the year for all four quarterly brew offs, and you got best of show for that. And so it's funny because I asked you as a result also to present the best of show for this particular quarter, and then you won first place again. So as somebody who has won multiple awards, what is your most favorite beer that you are the most proud of?
Sure. I've won with a lot of different styles. And I think it's more of like it comes down to, you know, what the beers are that you really like, maybe something that you went out on a limb with. You know, maybe my favorite beers aren't necessarily ones that I've even entered into competitions, because I thought maybe they don't really, you know, that might be an okay specialty ale or something like that. But, you know, it's sort of, if it's really tailored to your style and what you like, again, like maybe it's not, you know, the perfect competition beer. But I've got, I've made a key lime milkshake IPA that I really like.
Ooh.
And that's I've entered it into a couple competitions, but it tends to not do all that great. And that, even though I think it's a delicious beer, and that's because it's got it has key lime, lime zest, graham cracker, vanilla. I use a blend of hops that are New Zealand lime hops, so it gives it like a nice key lime pie flavor.
So what makes it milkshake? Do you add lactose?
Lactose, to it? Okay. Yes, lactose. And since you're a hazy IPA with all that sort of thrown into it. So but you know, I'm really proud of that recipe because it's something that I didn't read it in a book or you know, like it wasn't somebody else's recipe. I just put it together over time based on you know, what I like. And key lime pie was always my favorite growing up. I used to ask my mom for that instead of birthday cake from starting at like age 8. And every year, as soon as key limes are available, I always make that as my birthday beer every year.
My fiance, he doesn't really do much cooking or baking. I mean, generally when he does, he's like very much follow the recipe. But ironically enough, the one thing that he has you know, dialed in over time is a key lime pie, and he makes an incredible key lime pie.
One other, something else popped to mind is our club had worked on a big Russian Imperial Stout, and we did a reiterated mash on that to max out the vessel that we were using to make sure everybody got a share of it. But I ended up last year I won Prolific Brewer of the Year at the Shamrock. And two of the beers from that Russian Imperial Stout ended up being two of the six that won awards. And that was just a great Russian Imperial Stout recipe. It was one that we'd looked at some of the different gold awards from the past national homebrewing competition and kind of looked at components of each of those and built it into one recipe. And
nice.
We brewed it on a big system. Everybody got a share. It was, you know, those are always so much fun doing a brew day like that because everybody uses different yeast, add different adjuncts to it, ferment at different temperatures, and really, you know, everybody's beer comes out as a different finished product. But again, it's sort of like crowdsourcing those different experiences and understanding, like, you know, I really like coffee or I don't really like coffee in a beer that's a big Russian Imperial Stout or any of those other flavors. So. I was proud of that that beer too as a club effort.
That was definitely a very strategic way of going about brewing a beer for a competition that was coming up, as looking at previous beers that have done well and then, you know, essentially creating your own based off of that. That's very smart. Well, speaking of homebrew clubs, you've mentioned that a lot. What is your homebrew club, and tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. Our club is the Garner Ale Society. That's GAS, you know, of course, for the acronym. We meet at mostly at Beer of the Lady in Garner. Sort of a backstory there is that bottle shop had opened up. It's about 6 or 7 years ago. So shout out to Antares and Shannon, the owners. Who from the very get-go had said, we're sort of feeling out different people that like craft beer and said they were homebrewers and wanted to start a homebrew club at their bottle shop. And so got to talking to some other people just standing around the bar, you know, sampling at the lady. And quickly figured out that there were quite a few people in Garner that, you know, just they didn't go to any of the other clubs because they were just too far away. And we kicked off our first meeting shortly thereafter and really had a diverse group of people and diverse experience levels, too, with brewings. We had one of the great parts about that is all the education that you get from going to the different club meetings. Just all the expertise that all the other homebrewers have might be a little bit different from your experiences. But one club meeting, we did plating yeast with a loop and had never done that before, even though I had, you know, read about doing it. We've done the aroma sensory kits, we've done a tasting sensory kit, and then we've really leaned on, again, I've mentioned crowdsourcing to sort of learn new things about brewing. So we might start all with the same wort and say, okay, everybody's going to do a different new yeast, or everybody's going to do a different new single hop. And then we've all learned something, or a different, like slightly different base grain builds. And you learn about the grain, the yeast, the hops, and, you know, across maybe 8 different samples without having to brew 8 of those by yourself. I think that, reading it in a magazine, like Zymergy is fantastic as a wealth of knowledge for recipes. But it being able to, you know, taste those differences. Side by side, it just, you know, saves you a lot of time.
Being in person and being able to actually talk to people about it and see it and have hands-on experience. That's
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's your instant feedback on all those too. So you're not left alone to wonder how well it worked out or not. You've got some feedback from your, the club members. I feel like our club is focused on good feedback too. So it's not just, that beer's pretty good. Or good job on that beer. It's like, hey, you know, there's something off with this. I don't know exactly what it is, and sort of kick around like the taste and the aromas, and like, what is that? Is that, you know, is that cheesiness for the hops? And like, okay, well, what can cause that? Old hops, and you really try, like, hey, You know, what was this a fresh bag of hops, or is this something you use? Oh yeah, that was 2 or 3 years old. Okay, well, this is what that tastes like when you use old hops.
Yeah.
And so really try to, you know, get that feedback and drill down on different off flavors. Or hey, man, this is fantastic. Like, tell us, you know, about the different schedule, or like, when did you dry hop it? Not just, hey, you know, I dry hopped it with X amount of hops, but okay, well, tell us what temperature it was at, like how far into fermentation. Did you dry hop it all at once, or did you add it in increments, and did you pull it off, did you pull the beer off the hops, and like all those different details that you're never going to find in a recipe. And you know, being able to taste that difference when somebody else did the same thing as you, except they have like a slightly different hop schedule or yeast fermentation temperature, I feel like you just learn a whole lot real quickly.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember actually going to one of Garner Ale Society's meetings, and you guys were passing beer around, and we were talking about the different beers that were being passed around, and there was one that, you know, everyone was like, this is really good. There's just one certain thing that I can't pick up on, and it was umami, which was yeast autolysis.
Yes, yeah.
So I was, you know, the one that was able to come in and be like, what was your fermentation like? And got the story behind it and said, yeah, I left it on the yeast cake a little bit too long. And I said, yep, that's yeast autolysis.
Yeah. Yeah.
So soy saucy.
Right.
You know?
And I think you learn, and I know that with classes and off flavor classes, you learn that pretty quickly that you have blindness to certain flavors and aromas. Mm-hmm. And so you might not think anything is off with your beer, or maybe something slight and other people are super sensitive to it, and right away I'll be like, oh, that's diacetyl, or that's any number of things, oxidation. A lot of people can pick that up, but there are some that are blind to it. So
yeah, I'm blind to diacetyl. Okay. I just got really lucky on my Cicerone test that it wasn't on there, which also in a way kind of messed with my head, because I'm going, okay, I know that I'm blind to this, so am I just not detecting it, or is it not here? And thankfully, it just wasn't there. I went with my gut, and glad I did.
And even with something like that, you can pick up some tips along the way, like, hey, I don't taste it, but I can feel it. There's a mouthfeel.
Slickness.
Yeah, and learning those differences, and again, what you're sensitive to or not. You know, it's especially when you have different people that are handling their beer a little bit differently than you do, and you know, their process is a little bit different than, you know, maybe you always have like super clean beer and there's never ever any funk or anything like that, but somebody else has that, and you're exposed to that through a club, and you can help give them feedback on how to better clean their equipment. Seeing other people's talking to other people about how they brew is always fascinating too. I would say, if you haven't already, if you're a home brewer out there, or if you're somebody that's looking into starting, definitely take the moment to brew with somebody else, brew with another
100%.
Homebrew club member, and you'll learn a lot of things about their process, and they'll learn a lot about, you know, you're like, oh, well, I don't do it this way, I do it that way. And they're like, oh, okay, well, why do you do that? And you're starting to ask those questions, why? And you learn a lot faster that way than trying to figure it out all by yourself.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, speaking of equipment and brewing process, what is it specifically that you started with equipment-wise, and then what do you have now, and how has it changed?
Okay, yeah. I had built the John Palmer setup. That was a turkey fryer and a igloo cooler with a little mesh hose, and built my own copper chiller. And I thought, great beer on that for over a decade. Just fermenting in glass carboys. At first, I didn't have any temperature control, and figured out pretty quickly I needed something for that. It's probably, you know, cleaning and sanitizing your equipment, and temp control are, you know, the biggest things you can do to immediately improve the quality of your beer, no question. So had gotten a fridge unit, and actually had retrofitted a Red Bull tank.
Nice.
Like one of the cans from the like convenience store. It was cool, and it was like a small footprint. I could stick it in the garage. The only problem is it was like acrobats trying to get a 5 or 6.5 gallon carboy in and out of one of those without a lift or something like that. It ended up dying. I ended up picking up some Panasonic fridges from Reuse It. for temp control and, you know, some little ink birds to control it, and that had been great. But I finally decided, you know, I hadn't spent any money on homebrewing really for a long time, any of the equipment, and I thought, okay, I do want to keep doing this, but I want it to be easier and I want it to take less time.
Yeah.
So I put some, one of our club members had already purchased a Spike unit and a conical, as well as electric kettle. And he helped me put together my list for what I needed to buy to make a really great system. So now I've got a, it's makes a finished 10 gallons of beer for both the electric kettle. I think it's a C, I can't remember, C10 or 15, but it's the 15-gallon kettle and a 15-gallon conical. And those have been great. They you know, a pump with the system, so I'm not having to move beer manually, which again, there's nothing wrong with. It's you know, you can still make great quality beer. It's just a little bit less you know, elbow grease, a little bit less work. And a little bit less back strain. So, you know, I can transfer my finished beer into the conical, and from start to finish with cleaning and everything, probably about 4.5-5 hours, whereas my turkey fryer setup with the igloo cooler is taking me on average 6. So got about 1.5 hours back. So before, I would have never brewed on a weekday, but occasionally now, if I'm have a really busy weekend and I want to squeeze in another brew, I'll start brewing at like 5 o'clock and I'll knock it out and be done at 10 p.m. And
goodness gracious, I still don't know that I could do that.
I wouldn't do that with a beer that was wildly different or is going to have a really long boil time or something that I hadn't done before. But if it was if it's a pretty similar style, then I pretty feel confident knowing I should be able to finish that in 4.5-5 hours.
So. Yeah, we generally, when we're brewing here in the shop, we brew on the mash and boil, which is like the all-in-one 5-gallon electric system.
Yep.
And generally we try and at least, if we're going to start a brew in the shop, we have to start by 12 o'clock.
Yeah.
Otherwise we'll be, you know, still cleaning up and everything by the time that beer 30 comes around. And we want to make sure that by beer 30, we can actually sit down and enjoy a beer.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's some things that you can do to prepare the day before, obviously.
Oh, and, yeah, absolutely.
And it helps a little bit on the next day. And I'll even hang my stuff up. My system's tri-clamp, so I'll hang it all up to dry, and I'll put stuff away the next day.
So, yeah, smart. Yeah. So what is one piece of equipment you absolutely cannot live without?
That's a tough one because there's sort of like the, you know, the obvious answers, but, you know, obviously have to have a brew kettle and those kind of things. But the pieces of equipment that I love that I just can't imagine brewing without would sort of twofold, my tilt. So the going from glass carboys to stainless steel is kind of hard to you know, tell what's going on in there, right? And so the tilt, you drop that in, it's Bluetooth. They've got some other units that are similar, not by tilt, but same idea, that are Wi-Fi connect to your phone and to tell you what's going on with your fermentation. And then hand in hand with that is my spunding valve, which I recently got.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a must have, but fits into that category of it's a really nice to have because, again, it tells you like what's going on. Is the, you know, the beer putting out CO2? Is it fermenting? And then on top of it, it shortens the carb time by a couple of days. You know, it's coming out of the conical at 10-12 psi and most of the way carbonated.
Nice. Yeah, spunding valves are definitely really nice to have. But for me, unfortunately, I don't think I'll be getting one probably for another couple of years because they're a little pricey.
It's, you know, it's I was looking at it as so is CO2. And
so is CO2.
And when we had a shortage a couple times, I'm like, you know what? There's all the CO2, you know, I'll invest in the valve and it'll save me. You know, I only need enough CO2 to push the beer out, maybe finish up the carbonation and conditioning. But so far, so good.
Excellent. So what is the biggest mistake that you have made in homebrewing and what did you learn from it? Or a mistake?
That's a tough one because there are so many. And I feel like anybody that's probably brewed for a decade plus has, I mean, unless you're just lucky, you've done all the things wrong at least once. That's how I unfortunately tend to learn. I've had the pretty early on, I had an experience where we were sitting in our family room, and there's this just loud pop. And my wife said, "What was that?" And I said, "I know exactly what that was." And I run upstairs to the closet that I've been keeping a Russian Imperial Stout in, and it had exploded all inside the closet and was just a black volcano.
Oh,
just unstoppable.
No.
And it was, I think I lost like a third of the batch to the floor, you know, the carpet and everything. That was a disaster to clean up. So that was the last time I fermented in my closet. That was also the last time I fermented with
on top of carpet.
Yeah, and with just an airlock, with something that has a high volume of sugar that's going to go crazy, especially at higher temperatures. But you know, I didn't know what I was doing. So, but you know, it only takes one of those to never have that mistake happen again. That's probably, I mean, cleanup wise was probably the worst one. Close to that, I went to put a black the ball lock, the liquid line ball lock on a keg. And I don't know what I was doing. I think I thought it was a different one, but I snapped it on and realized it was the wrong keg. It was fully carbonated, and it was just the poppet, and so it blew beer directly behind my shoulder. And it just happened to be, because that was the way that I snapped it on, it just happened to be pointed at both of the vehicles we had in the garage, and both of them were just covered in beer. So I mean, I probably only lost, you know, a handful of pints of beer before I was able to pull it back off, but then, you know, how to wash the cars, all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, with kegging, it's so easy to make, you know, you sort of have to pay attention. It's easy to, you know, unhook or hook in the wrong thing if you're being absent-minded.
Yeah, my least favorite thing is when I go and I fill a fermenter or a keg with all of this delicious beer that I just finished making, and then I realize that my gaskets have gone bad and I start getting leaks. So yes, there was one of my kegs that for some reason it just continuously leaked, and I couldn't figure out why. Finally figured out which gasket it was, but I lost probably about a half keg. So probably about 2.5 gallons to the floor underneath the couch.
Right. That just makes you like everybody else. I feel like everybody's lost a tank of CO2 in the process. I'm still to this day, I'll carb my tanks. I'll turn off the CO2 when I'm done. I'll turn off the different gas line, you know, everything off. And then if I've got a leaky keg, I can pretty quickly figure out which one it is instead of figuring it out when all your CO2 is gone. You know, it's you can figure it out eventually, but it's nice to not have to have two or three kegs of beer and no way to get it out at home.
Yeah, that is the worst feeling ever when you've just like spent so much time and then all of it goes out the window. Yeah. It's like, damn it!
my biggest recipe mistake was probably one of my friends who loves doing his own smoked barbecue and everything. He smokes everything. I was like, "Hey, I really want to do a smoked beer." And I'm like, "Okay, I love smoked beer. Let's do one." And he's like, "Oh, I want to smoke the grain for it too." And I said, "Okay, well, you know, we could do you know, beech wood, and that would be like pretty standard smoked beer grain to do." So bought the grain, went over to his house, took it, and we put it on the smoker. And I said, okay, probably, I think like maybe 2 to 4 hours, we're supposed to spray it down with some water so that the smoke has something to stick to. And I said, and that should be plenty. And then, you know, I'll pick it up tomorrow and I'll brew with it. So the next day I asked him how everything went, and he sent me a picture, and it looked like it was caramelized. And he said, well, 4 hours didn't seem like it was enough. So I smoked it overnight. And it
Been
smoked for about 12 hours or so. And I said, okay, well, you know, we'll still brew with that. And maybe I'll use about a quarter of what the recipe calls for, and I'll use the rest base grain. We were making a Baltic porter. It was so delicious, except that it tasted like barbecue sauce. So it was not really a way to recover that. And I mean, it just had that deep barbecue flavor, which would have been incredible in food, but just was not the right balance for beer.
Goodness gracious, it's starting to sound like, you know, the Bojangles hard tea. And you know,
make it a whole meal.
Yeah, exactly. All righty. So what advice do you have for folks who are interested in starting the hobby and or interested in entering a beer to a competition for the first time?
For the hobby, I'd say, you know, just take it slow and easy. I definitely jump in with both feet and go for all grain, that kind of thing. But, you know, you don't have to learn everything in a day. Definitely join a local homebrew. There'll be a local homebrew club. They'd be happy to have you. They'd be happy to show you the ropes. And you really will learn a lot more that way. Absolutely check out the homebrew classes, because that's, you know, it's just even more information. It's, you know, trained staff and you know, discounts on you know, recipes, that kind of thing. And that gives you a good base to start with. And then you can grow from there, your equipment, all that kind of thing. But definitely take the time to find out if it's the right hobby for you. If you love learning, then it's going to be a great hobby. If you hate learning, it's probably not the right hobby for you, because there's a lot to learn. As far as competition, definitely make sure that you're entering the right category, that your beer is fresh. Be very careful with not introducing oxygen when you're bottling. A lot of the competition, like I had mentioned earlier, is packaging. So I was surprised to find out that some people just use their tap or their spigot to pour it into a bottle. I'm like, no, you have to use a bottler or a little piece of tubing. Like you see at a brewery that is bottling a growler, turn your pressure down. If you're kegging to 2-3 psi, you don't want the beer to rush or foam into the bottle, and then fill it to the top and cap it on foam. I think that's a lot of people will talk about that, but that's a way to protect against oxygen in those bottles. If you're all bottle conditioned, then, make sure that you're, being careful of that, adding oxygen when you're bottling. You know, be gentle with stirring that priming sugar. Make sure that you get the priming sugar, it's completely homogeneous as much as possible, or else you'll have some bottles that are way overcarbed and some that are undercarbed.
And it's
just bottle roulette. You have no idea what you're sending to the judges. And then, for your own benefit, whatever, you bottle an extra one for you, set it to the side, stick it in the fridge or whatever. And then in 2 or 3 weeks, 4 weeks, whenever that it's going to be judged, pop it out and check on it yourself. And, if you had something, some wild bacteria in your lines or something, too much oxygen in your process, then you're going to be tasting what the judges are tasting too.
Yeah, and one of the things that I'll say to that, in addition to, tasting it on the day that the judges are tasting it, is put it through what the beer is going to go through when it's being, after it's dropped off. So
sure.
If the competition organizers are not putting it in a cooler or, some sort of refrigerator, make sure that it's around the same temperature that the competition organizers have it in. And then, the night before, place it in the fridge taste it on the day of. That is one of the most, to me, beneficial pieces of advice that someone could have given me before I entered beer into a competition was, taste it on the day of, because I got some feedback and I was going, I don't remember this. This doesn't make any sense. And then I went back and, tasted it and I was like, yep, they were right.
Right.
So that is a incredible piece of advice that I definitely 100% agree with.
And then definitely, even if it's your first competition, find out more about stewarding. Really is a fun day or a fun experience. Everywhere that I've ever stewarded or judged, I've really had a blast and learned a lot. So it's a surefire way to become a better brewer.
Absolutely. And, another thing too, like if you enter a beer into a competition, you can still judge and or steward. You
yes.
just can't judge or steward the particular category that you entered.
Yep.
And so that is a great way to see the process, what it looks like, and it allows you to game plan for the next time.
That's why I always enter an IPA when I'm judging.
So you don't have to drink all the IPAs. Yep, that's not the first time I've heard that. And, honestly, it's brilliant.
Judging hack.
Yes, absolutely. All righty. Well, to end this podcast, I would like to ask you, if you were a beer, what beer would you be and why?
I probably have to go back to the milkshake IPA that I mentioned before. And I would say, you know, a little sweet, a little tart, and overall, it's actually kind of a pain in the ass. So.
I love it. I love it. Awesome. Well, Eric, thank you so much for stopping by today and spending the time to be on From Mentality with me. You know, I'm sure that our listeners are going to greatly appreciate all of the advice and insight that you have into why entering competitions can be fun and rewarding and why it's important to be a part of a homebrew club.
And thank you so much for having me again. I had a blast.
Excellent. All right. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening into From Mentality. This is Kat Pierce, your host. Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this episode of From Mentality and that this conversation inspires you to brew your best.